Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical...
sort of.
...podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
Guys, how are we?
Doing awesome.
Damn good, Kaveh.
Nice. I like it. Strong.
I'm doing awesome because I literally just got a text from my friend Versha that she's cracking up because she's listening to the anniversary episode where Joe refers to the doctor's higher calling and the oath that we take about the hypocritical oath, which I, in the moment, was so funny. And I'm really glad that other people are appreciating what we've known about Joe, this earnest, fun, sometimes not stupid.
No. Joe, was that, were you just misspeaking or is that actually what you thought it was?
That's a great question, Kaveh. And I have to totally admit it was not a misspeaking or an accident. I just thought it was called the hypocritical oath. It doesn't make sense. Never really questioned it in my mind for some reason.
You know what? It makes it that much funnier. Makes me love you just that much more. Yeah. So
that was a moot point. So we have a great interview coming up. Actually, I'll admit that we've already done the interview and we want to get right to it. But before we do that, I want to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners who took the time to post a review on iTunes, and this really helps us, so we appreciate it and want to give it a brief read. It's from Aliuzer, which we've been debating how to say it. I think it's a loser.
And I think it's a winner.
Aliaser?
Aliaser, maybe.
That's a real name, actually. That could be it.
Maybe.
Elijah?
A podcast for and about doctors, residents, med students, future med students, and regular old Joes that are interested in medicine. See what he did there? That's nice. Why aren't there better ways to test for cancer? What is bipolar disorder and what are the signs? What TV shows or movies represents the world of medicine most accurately? These are just some of the questions discussed on this podcast. Learn about the challenges healthcare providers face and the future of medicine on the House of Pod, a medical podcast. Very cool. Thank you, man or woman. Or
yeah, that was awesome.
Non-binary person. We appreciate it. Please keep those coming. They really do help us get more listeners when you rate and review us. And if you have any questions, don't forget our phone number, 408-444-6623. That is 408-444-6623. And our email is hopquestions@gmail.com.
We are here with Faye Jamali, former anesthesiologist in San Francisco, who's here to tell us about her personal struggle with addiction and how she mostly won the battle. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a daily battle. And yes, I continue to be in recovery almost 10 years coming up in October. So
that's incredible.
Very grateful.
Will you tell us a little bit about your story? You've been public on interviews and articles, and it's just a fascinating story of how this successful doctor overachieving, you know, and how a person who you would never suspect had to deal with this.
Well, first off, let me just thank you for having me over to share my story. I feel like the more we're able to tell our stories, there will be less of a stigma associated with this disease, and it is a disease. So as a physician, I just look at it as far as it's a public health safety issue. And by shedding the light, I hope that we can have some smart policies regarding what's happening in our country right now with the opioid epidemic. So if my story helps anyone, that it will be worth it. So I was probably, I always thought of myself the least likely person to ever have a problem with substance abuse. I come from a Persian family. I immigrated here to the United States when I was 16.
Kaveh's super excited.
I thought we were going to do this whole interview in Farsi, by the way.
You would be sorely mistaken.
Khubi, I got khubi, khubam, khubi.
Well, I speak Farsi, but Joe doesn't, so it wouldn't be fair.
Oh, you do.
Anyway, sorry. So go ahead.
So anyway, I immigrated here. I was 16 years old, so junior in high school in San Jose, California. And no family history of problems with addiction, alcohol. Didn't even know any friends or relatives who had issues with this. So came to the U.S., went to Berkeley and got my degree in physiology with emphasis in art. Also, I'm a painter. Then applied to medical school, did that, went to UC Davis. Then I did UCSF for anesthesia. You know, I remember as an anesthesia resident, we had a lecture on addiction, 1 hour course. And I was sitting there listening, but going, oh, this is so not me. What, I'm like, I was barely listening to it. Like, I graduated Berkeley, and this is a true story, without ever having tried marijuana. Kind of tells you how just not interested in drugs I was. Yeah, I would have drinks at parties and stuff, but I just never, you know, I had fun in college, but was not interested in any kind of drugs.
I'm surprised they let you graduate.
I know, go figure.
I went to Berkeley too. Not everyone smoked the dope.
I'm not saying you need to smoke it all the time every day, but I feel like having tried it is part of the curriculum.
The college experience.
I'm just saying, that's... Berkeley has a reputation.
Yeah.
Maybe not when you guys are there.
I think it's all college.
That's all college. Well, here's the aside.
This is true. Joe is correct.
Total aside, but I'm going to tell you something about Berkeley. Everyone expects Berkeley to be like this bastion of super progressive, like out there free thinkers. And there's certainly that at the school, but mostly it's like kids that couldn't afford Stanford and are super hardcore and like want to study really, really hard. So the pre-meds there are pretty scary. They're as scary as they are,
which is why I wasn't pre-med for a long time. I told my mother I'm going to be an artist, and she said, over my dead body. Nice. I didn't immigrate. They said, I didn't immigrate to this country for you to be an artist on the street in Berkeley. So you will apply to medical school.
That's adorable.
So I only applied to two.
Yeah.
And gosh darn it, I got admitted. So I think somebody upstairs was looking out for my mother. Same thing with residency. I chose anesthesia and I thought, okay, I'm only going to apply to UC and Stanford and that's it. And if I don't get in, I'll go to grad school in art.
Wow.
And
you were like, you didn't really want to go, huh?
Right,
I really didn't want to go.
You didn't want to go. If you only play a few places, because like there's pre-meds that like will apply to like 100 places.
Two places on match day. I was like, oh my God, I got in.
It
like
happened.
I was, you know,
right.
In medical school at Davis, I was having fun working on my tan, I think, whereas my husband was on the cover of Science during medical school. We had very different.
Wow.
But anyway, so when I got into anesthesia, and I always wanted art in the background.
You went straight through, sorry about that.
Straight through.
Yeah.
High school, Berkeley, med school, anesthesia residency. And the way this all started was I was at a joint birthday party for my son and daughter. They're both July babies. This was in 2007. And as I was walking back to the car, we were at Oakland's Children's Fairyland for a birthday party. And as I was walking back to the car to get the goodie bags for the kids, I slipped and fell and I broke my wrist, which was kind of a bummer, a lot of pain. Went and had, ended up having a couple of surgeries for my wrist fracture and was prescribed pain medication by the orthopedic surgeon. And it was a big bottle. I'm looking at this was 10 years ago. It was probably 100 pills in that bottle. I think he was trying to be nice in that, oh, you're a fellow physician. I don't
professional
want
professional courtesy.
You don't. I don't want you to have to call back for a refill.
You won't abuse this.
Right. No, and I didn't have any history of it before.
But
at
it's
all.
Also this concept of like conferring doctors or your colleagues a greater sort of some higher integrity. That maybe responsibility or ability to control that you might not have.
I agree with that. But I also think at that time, back in 2007, we were told to treat pain aggressively.
Yeah. Right. We didn't know.
They wanted us to get you down to a pain score of 2 out of 10 on a scale.
Because I remember specifically being taught when we were in medical school that you have to think of pain
as
a vital sign, and you have to treat it no matter what, which is makes sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But they would also say there is no evidence that giving medication after surgery for surgical pain creates addiction. And I remember being a medical student and being like, that seem right to you? That doesn't seem right to me. But I remember they kept telling us that. To treat pain aggressively.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, as an anesthesiologist, we were told that too. I mean, we're not really responsible for the pain medication that our patients go home with. Those are the surgeons that prescribe that.
Yeah.
But we were told to aggressively treat pain. And this orthopedic surgeon wasn't outside the box in the number of pain pills he gave. Yeah. That was what was told, that the chance of addiction is extremely low. They were told by manufacturers of these drugs.
Right.
The chance of addiction is extremely low when treating surgical pain.
This is just like the tobacco industry
in
the early 90s where... You know, there's this whole almost propaganda where it's like, it's safe. We've been under treating pain.
Absolutely.
It's so sad. This is a vital sign. We should sort of research this. I'm sure there's articles or books about maybe how the pharmaceutical industry sort of released this. We've been under treating pain. This is, you know, be more aggressive, because the pendulum clearly now has gone swung in when you fell and you broke your wrist and you need it. We need to be aggressive. And now obviously we're swinging back and... It's just a really interesting kind
I think
of history.
We have to absolutely be aggressive in treating pain.
Yeah.
But treating pain doesn't have to be just with opioids. Mm-hmm. As an anesthesiologist and as internship, there's multimodal analgesia. There's ways of we can treat pain, not with just opioids.
Let's definitely get back to that.
But yes.
Let's get back to the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was given a bunch of these pills, had a lot of pain. Also, I have a history of migraines and history of depression, off and on, mostly postpartum. So I took the pain pills as prescribed for the pain. And the pain got better. But what I noticed was that when I did take the pain pills, the Vicodin, things didn't bother me as much. It was like the stress of having two small children, a husband who was barely home, we're having some marital troubles. To me, it was like it smoothed out the edges. So I think that's when I started using it, not as prescribed, but as something to just calm me down. I was not a drinker. I'm not one that would come home and have a glass of wine. I just didn't drink. It would trigger migraines for me. So for me, it was kind of like my glass of wine. And I had a big stash of these. Well, I would just use it once in a while, but I think that's when things got blurry for me as far as the appropriate use of narcotics.
Mm-hmm. You stopped making good decisions.
Absolutely. And I wasn't, again, not taking it as prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting at this time, I felt like my depression was getting worse. Ding, ding, ding. You're taking an opioid. It's a downer. So my depression was getting worse. Just life seemed ridiculous to me, and I just didn't seem to manage things well. And I remember I was at work one day, and I got a really bad migraine. Once in a while, I would actually have to go to the ER and get an injection. It would be that bad. I tried every medication you can think of. I'd gotten Botox injected into my scalp and all kinds of meds. But once in a while, when it was so bad, I would just go to the ER.
For dilated?
Yeah, or whatever the person would give me.
Yeah.
So for an intravenous shot of it. So it was end of a shift, and I was going to go downstairs to the ER. And then I realized, in my pocket, I had the... as anesthesiologists at the end of the day or at end of cases, leftover medication that we have, we waste. So I was getting changed and I noticed, oh, okay, I have to waste these drugs. And I looked at the drug that I had in the vial, and it was exactly the drug they would have been giving me in the ER.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, well, I'm a doctor. I'm an anesthesiologist. Mm-hmm. Why do I have to go deal with waiting an hour downstairs? Mm-hmm. I can just give myself this medication. I'm done with my shift. And it'll be done. And I remember going into a bathroom and doing that and feeling such guilt and shame. Yes, it took care of the pain, but I was like, oh my God, you just crossed the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is insanity.
You knew it at the time.
I knew it was just wrong.
Yeah.
So I would get these migraines cyclically during a certain time of the month. So the next day, got a migraine again. It would always be at the end of the day by the time the stress is just like too much. And this time I didn't even think twice about it. I'm like, I know exactly what I'll do.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's that mm-hmm. first time, you know, when people yeah. first right. steal or whatever, you yeah. break, you do cross a line.
And so when I went and injected the second time, that's when I got the euphoria. The first time was just to take care of the pain.
Yeah.
The second time I, something broke in my brain. I felt this immediate rush of euphoria, and I was then angry at myself for, oh my God, all these years you had access to this feeling and you never used.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That kind of shows you that right. your brain just becomes hijacked.
By yeah. the disease?
By the drug, yeah. I think it's interesting the way, and looking back at it, the way I use drug intravenous is much more likely to lead to addiction and very quickly, as opposed to pills, you gradually start yeah, taking it.
Right.
And, you know, people always ask me, well, why did you inject drugs? I'm like, well, because I'm an anesthesiologist. That's what you do.
But that's the difference between like Xanax and Valium. Yeah. Like the peaks are much higher, much more intense, much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been shown to be more addictive.
This was a shot straight to your pleasure centers.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned that you would go to ERs, you'd go to different doctors, and you had an experience, you thought of at least going to ERs, and that was an option. Did you find yourself ever in that situation that you were trying to game the system a little bit?
No, I think I'd only done it twice in my life.
Okay.
It was rare. Usually I could fix it first I start with Excedrin, then some sumatriptan, then like just go into a dark room.
Yeah.
So no, I wasn't one that went to ERs frequently, but I knew that when it got really bad, that's the option.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, I'm a doctor. I can do it myself.
And you probably justified it in your head because that's what you do when you have an addiction. You're like, well, I'm actually saving the ER time.
Right.
I'm saving the hospital money, the taxpayer,
blah,
blah, blah.
I did not think of myself as an addict.
Right.
I thought of myself, I'm a doctor. I am treating this pain.
Mm-hmm. You're saving.
I cannot be an addict. I'm a soccer mom.
Right.
You know? Like,
so for Joe, the ER docs, we should have an ER doc, pride themselves on being able to sniff out these people who Kaveh is alluding to are gaming the system, where they'll go from ER to ER to ER every day, every weekend to say, I'm in such severe pain, I need Dilaudid. Then they'll go to the next ER, I'm in such severe pain, I'm allergic to aspirin, I'm allergic to Tylenol, I'm allergic to Toradol, I need Dilaudid or fentanyl.
Wow.
And you know, you clearly didn't have that history, which is why the doctor gave you 100 pills of whatever the drug of the day was. And can you also explain to Joe and our listeners, you said at the end of the day you would go and waste. And, you know, Kaveh and I do procedures every day with Versed, you know, which is midazolam, a benzodiazepine-like Xanax or Valium. And we use fentanyl, which everyone knows now, a morphine kind of friend. And our nurses have to waste any medicine we don't use. And there's always two nurses, and they go to this computer. They have to put their finger in, and one has to watch the other waste drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
So back then, was it different 10 years ago, or do anesthesiology? Because I actually don't know. Do the physicians not need someone to observe their waste?
We did, but it was a much less stringent. It would be like you go with like another doctor would be like, okay, just confirm that I wasted this. And half the time, they don't even look what you're wasting.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Again, when I started, it wasn't something that I did daily, but so this happened the first time I injected. Within a 3-month period, I had upped my dose tenfold.
Wow.
I started out with 25 mics of fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, I was doing one shot of 250 of fentanyl.
That's quite a bit.
At one time.
That'd be a very dangerous thing
as
for
an
Joe,
anesthesiologist.
For someone.
This is not something, even when someone's completely anesthetized, we rarely do that. But for someone with no history of addiction, I think I showed rare talent for it.
So was that your rock bottom? What was rock bottom?
There were quite a few rock bottoms.
It was a rocky shoal.
Yes. So, you know, when this happened, I didn't know what was going on with me. I kept saying, well, I'm going to stop this. No, I'm going to stop.
Or you can stop.
Yeah,
right?
That I can. I didn't know of anyone who was an addict. I really didn't. I just the addict to me was the homeless person on the street. It wasn't a doctor.
Right.
And I thought, I can stop this. I have dealt with much harder things in my life. I can definitely do this. And so I would make myself say, okay, I'm not going to use even one time this week. None. And what would happen is I would have a craving and I would inject. Thankfully, I never injected during work hours. But I was worried that, oh my God, if this disease progresses, I could hurt myself, overdose, or hurt a patient. I mean, I was terrified. And I kept thinking of my two children and that what would happen to them if I died of this. So I used to inject in my arms here, and I remember making myself put a Band-Aid on each arm and writing my children's names on each of them. Mm-hmm. And I told myself, look, pretend you are injecting into the eyeballs of your children. Mm. That will stop you.
Yeah.
Right? But when the craving hits, there is nothing that you can do. And I would rip those Band-Aids, inject, and feel even worse.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a disease that feeds on itself. It is not a moral shortcoming. It is a process that goes on in your brain. And unless you get help, this will kill you.
Hearing you tell this, thank you for sharing that, by the way.
Yeah.
You're going to make me cry.
Yeah.
It's not going to be pretty.
or me.
But
worse.
You sharing this, I think, is super important with doctors because you and I have a very similar sort of trajectory, you know, Bay Area, yeah. Berkeley, Davis, two kids, all that stuff. And you show beyond a doubt that this can happen to anyone. Yeah. And this is the kind of thing that can occur. And it is a disease process.
Yeah.
And you don't, doctors, we get frustrated by it. People get mad about this and it's hard. And we have to recognize it as a disease.
Yeah. And I mean, Kaveh and I do liver and we have all these patients who just keep drinking, even though their livers are done, scarred, cirrhosis it's called. And we, now I often say like, so you haven't drunk? Haven't drank. Great job. It's been 30 days. How are you going to continue that? And they'll say, no, I don't need help. I can do it. I'm like, you say that, but what happens when the bills, you know, you can't pay the bills or you're sad or whatever, what's your coping? Like I really now start to ask you, what is your infrastructure? And, you know, because people just say, I don't need AA. I don't need, we call it like a chemical dependency program. I don't,
CDRP.
They say no. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I don't think you're preparing for the future and the bumps that are going to come. And how can you do that? And a question I have for you is, why are anesthesiologists, or do you, I think it's known that anesthesiologists are more susceptible. Do you think that's a personality thing or a selection bias, or do you think it's actually access to medication or both?
I think it's a combination. There are a few specialties that tend to have higher percentage of physicians who get addicted. Anesthesiology, ER, and psychiatry. Those are the three professions. I think for anesthesiology, I think part of it is the fact that we are around those drugs daily. We have access to it.
Yeah.
So that will definitely lend itself to more. I don't know if it selects for people who want to be around these drugs. If it does, it is the quickest way of dying, man, because you have access to the most potent narcotics. And so for me, one of the, again, as far as my story and rock bottoms, other than that time with the Band-Aids with my children's name on it, there was one time where I went out to dinner with my husband, and we had a fight. It was like 8:30 at night, and I went straight to the hospital, walked straight into the recovery room with my civilian clothes, not in scrubs, said hi to the nurses, went to the narcotic machine, the Pyxis, just picked a random name, checked out narcotics, wasn't a patient I was taking care of or mm-hmm. anything, went to the bathroom, and I injected. I remember waking up. The needle was still in my arm. I had vomited. I had urinated on myself on the floor. And that's how anesthesiologists die in bathrooms. Because the first dose I gave myself was a safe one. But after that, you become altered. You're not a physician anymore. So you're like, oh, there's more left in the vial. And you give yourself more.
Just give them more.
Give what's
more.
There. Yeah. So that first dose, you might be a doctor and like, okay, I know exactly what to give and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I could have died in that bathroom, right?
Yeah.
So I got up. Instead of being horrified, I was angry at my husband because, God damn it, if we hadn't had this fight, I wouldn't have done this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That shows you the disease working.
Yeah.
That is the disease in process. And, you know, when you're talking about this is a chronic disease like diabetes, you know what? Do you say, okay, 28 days of insulin, then you're cured? No. This is a lifelong disease. The recovery is lifelong. You can definitely have an amazing life in recovery, but it's not like, oh, you're cured, you're done. No. Right.
There's no conquering this battle necessarily. Yeah. It's just it's a daily process.
It is daily, and you can win it every day, mm-hmm. but you do it every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got a question. Sure. Just in general with opioids, I mean, I've seen and heard a lot of stories like yours, Dr. Jamali, and I'm wondering why are opioids even used for pain? Is it just that's the only thing that will help with pain? And we just don't have the drugs for it?
No. There are certain conditions. Opioids are amazing analgesics or pain relievers. They really are. Patients with cancer, chronic pain, there's definitely a place for opioid. But the problem we got into is overprescribing it and only treating pain with opioids. It definitely has, for example, in surgery, you need opioids. Someone who's anesthetized having their belly cut open, you need opioids. It is rare to be able to do a surgery with no opioids. Occasionally we do, but we use other modalities like a local anesthetic, a regional nerve block, mm-hmm. an epidural, things like that. So right now our push has become, yes, opioids should be there. We shouldn't swing the pendulum so far back that we're not treating pain. We should aggressively treat pain, but we can do things like non-opioids, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Toradol. It's like a cousin of ibuprofen, but intravenous. Local anesthetics, nerve blocks, good physical therapy, acupuncture, you name it. There's so many things that you can do. So we shouldn't say opioids have no room in treating patients pain, but we should definitely do what we call a multimodal approach to it.
I think an important distinction is like acute pain, like post-op, mm-hmm. you know, you have surgery, and chronic pain. You know, we see patients like cancer patients, and mm-hmm. Kaveh and I see like irritable bowel patients, and you can't really take certain diseases and say we're going to give you a narcotic because you know the dose will just need to be escalated, and it shouldn't be for 3 months, 6 months, a year. And the multimodal approach is very smart to do. And you have to understand that every single medicine has risks and benefits. Addiction is one, you know, for narcotics, but like ibuprofen type medicines,
bleeding.
You know, Kaveh and I see stomach bleeding all the time. Yeah. Tylenol has liver, there's no perfect medication. Otherwise we would use it, but everything has to be like,
And I think that's why when you use two or three different drugs to treat pain, you use much less of each drug and you target pain from three different angles, three different ways. So it's actually better pain control with less problems.
Yeah.
So.
And pain is hard. It's subjective. You know, it's not the easiest thing to treat.
Absolutely.
So you've talked a little bit about what's changing in the OR in terms mm-hmm. of using nerve blocks instead of using more of the same medication. What needs to change in training? What needs to change mm-hmm. in terms of medical school? Because like I said, when we were in medical school, we were taught to aggressively treat with opioids and other medications. What needs to change?
And you said you had 1 hour of curriculum in your like 10 years of training. You know, that's insane.
I haven't been talking directly with different medical schools to see what's happening, but what I have been told that there's much more training on opioid prescription now. Mm-hmm. Even as physicians now, they track how much we prescribe. Mm-hmm. There is like, the push is to like no more than 5 days of narcotics after a procedure.
Oh, yeah.
So they're limiting this. And I think in medical school, they're finally getting to this. And yeah. also with anesthesia residencies, they're talking more about this. This opioid epidemic is awful, but at least it's shedding light on this situation.
Yeah. yeah. People yeah. are starting to learn about it.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
So in your story, what happened next? At what point after rock bottom, what mm-hmm. happened then?
So one day, I'd say 3 months into my using intravenous drugs, I was at work. I was finishing up a case, and someone said, "Hey, someone from administration wants to talk to you." And I was like, "Oh my God!" And you know what? I think subconsciously, I wanted to get caught because I would go to that machine and put my fingerprint on it, my name, mm-hmm. and just pick a random name. Of course, the pharmacy is going to find out just randomly picking stuff. So. Looking back, I think that was my cry for help, because during the time I was going through it, there was so much shame associated with it. I couldn't tell anyone. Nobody knew. Nobody mm-hmm. knew. I was never altered at work, never used at work. Nobody saw me using ever. So
your husband,
had no idea.
No suspicions.
None.
How many
Zero.
Times do you think you drove home from work impaired?
Didn't.
Yeah.
No, didn't.
Yeah.
I would probably, most of the times I would, I worked part time.
Okay.
So I would take the medications home
yeah.
and then use it on my day off mm-hmm. at home.
Okay.
That's mostly
yeah,
what I
yeah.
did. Yeah.
Because that's the kind of stuff that
no,
terrifies
that would be
me.
Terrified. You know? Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I knew in the back of my mind, this disease was progressing. I
yeah.
was using more
yeah.
and I was terrified. So anyway, they confronted me. I walked, they said, "We need you to come to this conference room." And I walked into this conference room. There was maybe 6 or 7 people around a table.
Oh, wow.
And
oh, wow.
they just said, "Dr. Jamali, we've been going over narcotic records and there seems to be a problem." And at that point, I didn't even have the presence of mind to say anything. I just kept saying, "I don't know. I don't know." I just, like, my world was crashing in.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Well, give us your badge. We're starting an investigation." That's it. So they accompanied me to my locker, checked my locker. There was no medications. And they sent me home. And I thought, "Oh, my God, what am I going to tell my husband? What am I going to tell my children?"
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do. I'm like, do I just pretend to go to work tomorrow and not go? Like, I just didn't know what to do. That night, interestingly enough, we had a marriage counseling session because our marriage was falling apart. And towards the end of the session, the therapist said, "Faye, you look really sad." And I just said, I blurted it out. I'm like, "Well, there's some drugs missing at work and they think I had something to do with it." And my husband comes rushing to my defense. They're like, "Don't they even know? You don't even drink. You don't do stuff. No, what are they mm. talking about?" And I felt so much worse. I was like, "Oh, my oh. God, he has no idea."
Right.
So we ended up going home that night, put the kids to bed. And then later on, I came downstairs where my husband was. And he just looked at me and he's like, "Faye, is there something you want to tell me?" And I thought, "Oh, God, this is it. This is where I tell him that I'm addicted to drugs. I've lost my job. We're already having trouble. He's going to divorce me. He's going to take the kids. I won't have a job." It was the lowest point of my life. It was the darkest time. I couldn't even say the words. I just rolled up my sleeves and I showed him the track marks on my arm.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, here it comes. This is it. And, you know what he did? Instead, he picked me up and said, "Sweetie, we'll get you help. Why didn't you tell me?" You know? And I don't think I've loved him any more than that. That moment was pretty amazing. And also, that was the moment where I thought, you know, the truth, no matter how hard and how dark your situation, telling the truth is actually the first step to getting better.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. The next day, I called up and told the hospital, and I went into recovery. There is a physician who is my guiding light, I'll just say his name, Dr. Pating. He had treated me years ago for depression. And so when the hospital had talked to him and said, we think this physician is diverting medications, they're like, no, she has no history of problems. He's an addiction doctor. And he was surprised, too, that this had happened to me. So he told me when I went to him and he said, Faye, this is going to be a long, hard road, but we're going to get you help. You can deal with this. Mm-hmm. And the kindness he showed at my darkest hour was amazing. And at the time, 1 month before this happened, they had stopped the California's what we call the diversion program, where physicians who are impaired, have problems with substance abuse disorder, go into a program where they do their recovery. And as long as they're successful in this program, the medical board leaves them alone. They had completely done away with it 1 month before this happened. Oh. So I had no idea what was going to happen to my license. I didn't know, but I needed to get help. So, at that point, I was told because I had a very short history of this, he didn't think I needed to go away for 3 months to like Betty Ford or something like that. I never bought drugs off the street. It was a short time, no history of it. And so he put me on an outpatient setting where I would go every day to a recovery program and come home at night to be with my children, which was great. First day in recovery, where I went to the program, I remember walking in, I was dressed nicely, had some pearls on, and this guy sitting next to me is like, hey, so what are you here for? Alcohol? And I looked at him, I'm like, no, I shoot up drugs. It just kind of shows you that you have this image of people who are IV drug abusers being homeless.
And you are not it.
Right, and the IV drug abusers had no idea that you could have been an IV. They're like, you don't belong with us.
You don't Yeah, I didn't fit. And when I went in there, though, I just thought, okay, 28 days, I can do this, right? I'll be cured after 28 days because I had no idea what recovery meant.
Yeah.
And it was only through recovery that I got the tools of being able to deal with life. Since I've been in recovery, I've had breast cancer. I've had 6 surgeries, double mastectomies. My mother had a massive stroke. I almost got divorced. But through all of this, I never used.
That's amazing. It's amazing with all those stressors.
Yes, despite all those stressors and going through 6 different surgeries.
So, 2 questions.
Yeah.
The big question overall is, what was it that prevented you from relapsing with all those stressors? And 2, specifically regarding the surgeries, how did you handle pain management?
Yeah. So, what happens with recovery is, if you are serious about recovery and you practice it every day, it doesn't mean life becomes rosy. Life still has ups and downs. It gives you the tools of dealing with life. A lot of the problems we have is whenever there's pain, we want to numb ourselves to the pain. So psychological pain, physical pain. But for me, what I learned through recovery is in order to deal with the pain, you actually have to feel it and get through to the other side of it. And so relying on your friends and family, going to meetings, meditation, yoga, taking care of yourself, not numbing yourself to the pain, taking it minute by minute sometimes, day by day, lets you get through it. Mm-hmm. But if you use, you have 30 seconds of euphoria and then nothing else. You have the same problems. The problem hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was great. And also when you have surgery, you have to have a plan when you're an addict. And the plan is usually you give the medication that you're supposed to take, like the Vicodin, whatever. I gave it to my husband. I didn't know where it was.
Yeah.
So they give it to you. You need it. You absolutely need it. We have some people who are poor purists and let's say AA or an A and like, no, doctor, I don't want it. So that's the problem is then the pain becomes so unbearable that they're go to IV heroin, let's say. You know what I'm saying?
They medicate themselves in some way.
You take it, and after 3-4 days of it, like take it, give it back to the pharmacy, flush it down the toilet. I don't care what you do. I never know where that medication was.
Yeah.
And also during that time, I up my time where I talk to my sponsor or talk to other people. Just like you have to have a plan in place before surgery and put it into motion.
Yeah. So. No, it's great. And why... I mean, you mentioned it before, but just we'll bring it home. Why talk about it? Why now? Why do you want to share your story?
You know, I think a lot of times when something has a stigma associated with it, then people don't want to help. And if I share my story, if I can show you that a hardworking physician with two children and a husband who you wouldn't think would ever become addicted, this can happen to me. It can happen to anybody. And my story, in all honesty, is no different than the homeless person who is addicted, because you are trying to numb yourself to some pain in your life, and then that medication hijacks your brain. So it's not a moral failing on your part. We should treat it as a disease, or else we're going to lose a generation to this disease. Yeah. This needs, if we can take away the stigma, there will be more of a public support for putting dollars in recovery programs. Because this is not something that you can just fix like you have an infection, a week of antibiotics, you're done. No. So this is a lifelong program. I think one of the reasons physicians are so successful in staying in recovery is you have an incentive. You have an amazing job that you don't want to lose. Mm-hmm. So again, so out there, if people have jobs, right. If they're not jobless, they have something to work forward.
Have to have something to lose.
Yes. And also we have the insurance and the means to get good recovery programs, go to an addiction program, recovery program. We need to make that available for non-physicians or people who can't afford it. Yeah. So, but none of that, all of that needs money. Right. And none of that money will be going toward it unless there is a public outcry about this.
And it sounds like you had the support system. You had
I was lucky.
Your employer, your family, your husband, your said friends. Like that sounds like, again, a huge element, not only addressing the crisis, but also then what to do for people who are currently in it. You know, prevention and treatment. So
absolutely.
I know that you've been speaking about this, but do you get doctors reaching out to you sort of personally? I'm assuming no one's posting it like on your Facebook page, like that they have a problem, but people
Correct.
Must be
yes.
coming up to
yes,
you.
Yes, absolutely. I've been very fortunate in that doing these podcasts and being out there, I've had friends of friends, other physicians reach out to me. And I am not an addictions specialist. I'm just telling my story and listening to theirs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's all you need. Someone who's not going to judge you, but actually offer you help.
We thank you so much for coming on the show.
My it's pleasure.
Been
thank you.
Such a wonderful kind of story. And you're very brave and honest. And I'm grateful, you know, for people that I know and I can refer. Is there a way that people can find you easily that, you know, if they want to reach out?
Yeah, absolutely. You can always reach out to me to my email, fayejamali@gmail.com. And that's spelled FAYEJAMALI @gmail.com. And then we can set up a time to talk. I'll be happy to come meet with you. Again, if I can just help one person, it's worth it.
Oh, I'm sure you already probably have. And I want to reiterate that, you know, Lizzie used the word brave, and we hear that word used a lot when people talk about their disease, but you are really particularly brave in this situation. We've had guests on who've come to talk about bipolar disease and mental illness. And when people come and talk about addiction, I mean, that takes real courage, because you don't have to. You could go about your life very well, and we would never have guessed. But you're doing it for the right reasons, and you want to share it and help remove that stigma. And we really appreciate it. Is there, what are you doing now briefly? Can you just tell us?
Yeah. You know, I left anesthesia a couple of years ago and, decided to focus on some, art and, combining art and medicine. So I got some training in aesthetic medicine, about to open my own business, in, Marin County. It's called Belle Marin in Mill Valley, where I'll be practicing the art of medicine, where I get to do, Botox, fillers, lasers, cool sculpting, things like that. So I'm really excited. It's a new chapter in my life, and I don't think I would have had the courage to get up and do something different if I hadn't had all these experiences. I am forever grateful that this happened to me, because of this, I didn't get my old life back. I got a better version of my old life back. And not that I recommend people have problems with addiction to get their life in order, but, you know, I'm grateful. And if I can just help someone else with this, then it'll be worth it. Great. Sharing my story.
I can't wait to come to Bellmer and get some work done.
Yes, Kaveh needs it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for
thank
coming.
Thank you.
Please make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and tell your friends to listen. You can email us at hopquestions@gmail.com or call us at 408-444-6623, and we are also now on Stitcher. All anecdotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.